For this interview, we stepped away from the wineries and the vineyards to visit with our friend Mickey Maddox, professor of theology at Marquette University here in Milwaukee. Mickey is also a historical theologian, a Luther scholar, and a graduate of UC Davis, the holy grail for up-and-coming winemakers in the U.S. Mickey and his wife Pam, along with their two sons, also lived in France for 4 years, experiencing some of the finest French wine up close and personal. Having been raised in California, wine seemed to be in his future, and that included living in Lodi, home to a well-known name or two. Mickey, tell me what you studied at UC Davis.
My undergrad degree is in agronomic science and management. This was an individual major designed by moi and approved by the university. So I did coursework in agricultural economics and in agronomy, and I was preparing for a career in agribusiness. And I, in fact, worked for the Farm Credit Banks of Sacramento, California for 5 years. And my first job was in a little town called Lodi, California. And that's where I got introduced to the wine grape industry. And part of our territory was Amador County. And Amador County at that time was sort of blossoming with new vintners, people out of the Bay Area for the most part, who were bringing money up there, developing wineries and trying to do something with these wonderful dry-farmed Zinfandel grapes. So I got to go all over the place, meet all kinds of people. And, you know, as part of my job description, I had to go to wine tastings. So, yeah, it really wasn't too bad. I don't know why I quit and went into the crazy business I'm in now, you know. But I had a great time.
So what time period was this?
I started 81 and was until 86. So that was sort of a farm crisis time, too, because, well, I don't know, the farm economy was in a real downturn. Land prices had gone down for the first time in, like, forever. After 5 years, I decided between law school or graduate school in history and theology. And I just decided to go crazy. And I just followed my interest. I did it because I wanted to and because my wife let me. And, you know. So it was just, you know, it was great fun.
I'm really curious to hear about your experience at Davis.
Davis was a fascinating place. And one of the things I got to know toward the end of my undergraduate studies there was the Department of Viticulture and Enology. Davis was a place where they were offering a PhD in winemaking, you know, which sounds like way too much fun for anybody to call it a PhD. But, you know, they took it all very seriously. And I met a lot of the folks who worked sort of on that side of things. They had all kinds of experimental stuff, you know, grafting, developing new grape varieties and that sort of thing, and new trellis systems. They had one single grapevine that, you know, covered like, I don't know, 200 square meters or something. It was a giant thing. You could walk underneath it. It was like a tree, just to, I guess, prove that they could do that. But all kinds of fun things going on there. And, I mean, Davis is a research university, I think. I don't remember the numbers, but I think there were about half as many grad students as there were undergrads. And it seems to me the number is somewhere around 20,000. I don't remember for sure, but there were a lot of grad students. And with that sort of focus on research, they had an outstanding faculty. But it wasn't really – it certainly wasn't about wine and grapes just as sort of, you know, fun and interesting. One of the most difficult courses I took toward the end of my time there, I had to take a course in plant science. I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was a course that dealt with plant growth regulating hormones. And it was easily the most difficult course I had to take. But we had to learn, for example, why a green grape will take on a blush and then turn dark. And, you know, what process, what hormones are involved in that kind of thing. So they were really, you know, folks are into the science there. Davis, for anybody who is interested in agriculture or, you know, sort of the business side of agribusiness, Davis was just – it was the best place. So I had to learn that side of things too. You know, that wine is also about culture and family and place and life and not just, you know, some commodity that you put in a bottle and sell.
You told me that your family had an agricultural background.
My grandfather was a cotton farmer. My dad was in a farm-related business, and I had, I think, that kind of typical American agrarian ideal somewhere in my head about how wonderful, you know, the farm life is and so on.
Tell me a little about Lodi.
Well, Lodi was interesting. I worked with, you know, lots of farmers who were growing wine grapes, And, you know, lots of folks who were also doing, you know, sort of, you know, making wine and that sort of thing. But one of the most interesting experiences I had while I was there, I worked for a locally owned cooperative bank. And the cooperative bank was run by a group of local farmers who were elected, you know, to sort of run the thing. And they themselves, almost all of them, were also wine grape growers. And one of them who was quite prominent, you may know Ironstone Vineyards. Yeah, John Couts, and I think it's his son Steve who runs it now. John was a member of our board at the time. And as memory serves, John was the one who arranged with his friend Bob Gallo that we should have lunch with Julio one day. And so the bank employees, there were only three of us, and our wives and the board and their wives all got to go and have lunch with Bob and Julio Gallo. Bob's the son of Julio. Bob and his dad, as best I remember now. He could be Ernest's son, but I think he's Julio's son. And so, you know, it was really just great fun because, first of all, they were late. So we showed up at a restaurant in Modesto, and these guys finally came. And Julio sat right across from me and my wife. So we got to sit there and talk with him all through the lunch. And a couple of things that I recall. One is he told us the story of how they started their winery, which was fascinating. I mean, they basically did it in the cellar with a book. And they did it because they were going broke packing grapes and shipping them back east. So they decided if there's any money in this, maybe it's in the wine. Let's try that. But the other thing was that Julio gave us this advice. Never pay more than $10 a bottle for wine because, you know, it's just – it doesn't get that much better after $10. And I think there was a while when the $10 rule was, you know, maybe valid, but it's been a while back now.
So did they take you on a tour of the winery?
Yeah, they took us on a tour of the winery afterwards. Yeah, and at that time they had 40 acres under one roof of all barrel fermentation, you know, just all a cellar underground but 40 acres under one roof. So, and they were just gigantic. And I think things have changed since then. But at that time, boy, Julio would fly around in his helicopter, drop down in the vineyards, take a look at your grapes, you know, check this and that, and then boom, away he goes. And everybody goes, you know, what's the great man going to say?
All right. Let's talk about the time that you lived in France.
In God's country, France? Yeah. Well, I applied for a job. And nearly was, you know, just bowled over when they offered me the position. I worked in a research institute in Strasbourg, France, and I had never prepared to work in France. I did not speak French. I could read the language, but I didn't speak it. Fortunately, the institute where I worked, the two official languages were German and English. This is Europe, so, you know, things sort of go that way sometimes. One of the best things that happened to us was my youngest child, whom you know, was disruptive one day when we were in a restaurant. And the couple seated at the table next to us, instead of having a bad reaction, had a very good one. And they turned out to be a wonderful French couple by the name of, perfect name, Jacques and Claudine. And Jacques and Claudine became our very best friends. We spent four Christmas Eves in their home. And both of them were professional chefs. One of the things I learned in France, and I learned it in part from them, is that wine is, yes, wonderful, but wine is more a food than a drink. And so it's something that goes with, that's part of what makes up a really satisfying and interesting meal. I think walking into a French, you know, bar and sort of ordering a glass of wine. Maybe you have a little aperitif or something, but you wouldn't like order, you know, some big cab and sit at the bar and, you know, drink a glass of Cabernet. I mean, that goes with something. It's part of something. I think that what I learned from them was that sort of sense of intentionality and taking time, giving time to life, to, you know, to a meal, to guests. I mean, hospitality was a big part of it. Claudine would never allow you in her kitchen to help serve the meal. Of course, she served in courses. But, I mean, she just wouldn't do that. I mean, it's just not right. And, you know, so I don't know. There's a lot of good things to learn from those folks. When we went to France, I had a couple of French colleagues, and they were both – I mean, every Frenchman has a wine cellar. Everyone keeps wine. And one of the things I learned in France is you must buy faster than you drink because the French are big on, you know, keeping it in the cellar and letting it age, letting the wine mature and become ready. So, for example, if you have a you know, if you've got a four-year-old bottle of Burgundy and you pop it and set it out on the table for dinner, people are going to think, you know, what happened? I mean, have they had some kind of financial crisis? They've run out of money. The cellar is empty. They're opening new wine. Why? Why would you do that, you know?
Tell me about the first wine experience you had while in France.
Our sort of initial experience was in the French hypermarket. The French hypermarket is like a gigantic Walmart, but they've got food and everything else all under one roof. Auchan and Cora, these big chain sort of food stores in France, and they'll typically have just a gigantic wine section, just huge, and all kinds of wines in there, a little bit of American stuff, lots of Italian, and just tons of French wine. And it's a bit like the cheese aisle. You know, the cheese aisle has 300 cheese, and you just have no idea how to pick. And the wine aisle, you just walk down and you go, oh, wow, how do I choose? You know, go by price, go by color. And so the first year, I mean, the big find was Black Cat, which was a South American wine. I don't recall for sure if it was from Argentina or where, but it was cheap. And we were settling in, didn't have a lot of money, and so we sort of enjoyed that. But the next year, with Claudine and Jacques' help, we soon realized that we're a mere 3 hours from the heart of Burgundy. And so we ended up making several trips to Burgundy over that time. And I came to really appreciate the Burgundy wines. I never made it to Bordeaux. Bordeaux is clear across the country from Strasbourg. And every region, of course, has its own wines. And, of course, they talk about, you know, terroir. And it's not just, you know, the wine, the soil, the climate, and so on. It's also the food that's grown up around these particular things and the kinds of pairings, the way they match things and so on. You know, I mean, from my perspective and with the background that I had, when I went to France, I thought, oh boy, I can't wait to get my hands on some great Bordeaux. Because Bordeaux, Cabernet, you know, I mean, the California wines, I kind of had a point of reference for that. And I sort of knew what that was and I was interested in it. Two things happened. One, a number of trips to Burgundy with friends and tasting and learning about the Pinot Noir. And, of course, I think the movie, which I didn't particularly like, Sideways, accurately portrays the Pinot Noir as a wine that insists that you pay attention and doesn't sort of hit you over the head but wants you to, you know, attend to it. But the other thing that I learned in France wine-wise, we also made a couple of trips to Chateau Neuf du Pape. You know, the Pope's new house down in southern France. And the Chateau Neuf was also something brand new for me. You know, the blend wines based around grapes that aren't that prominent, you know, on the American palate and so on. This was just an amazing discovery. And then it's not just, you know, these sort of great regions like Burgundy or Chateau Neuf, but also the little places, the little areas that don't get a lot of publicity but have also very interesting wines. Some of them, you know, sort of off the traditional map also for the French people. So the Languedoc, the Minervois, these, you know, wines that are less expensive, the Valley of the Loire, some of the wines, you know, over in the far eastern side of France as you come up into the Alps and the Jura. There were all these areas that, you know, of course, as an American, you just have no idea about this. But from my perspective, I mean, I don't have nearly enough money to really enjoy Burgundy wines or certainly not Bordeaux, because Bordeaux is so well known. Everyone, you know, buys it. The prices are just, you know, out of this world and so on. But with the Burgundies, at least living in France, living in the States, it's hard to buy Burgundies. They're very expensive here. But I could buy in Europe for 15, 20 euros, I could buy a really nice Premier Cru Burgundy or some pretty darn good Chateau Neuf du Pape. You know, that was very nice. Actually, my best find the whole time we were living in France was a wine from Volnay, right in the heart of Burgundy. It was just a regular Burgundy wine, not Premier Cru or anything like this. And we were buying it for 5 euros 50. And this was sort of my great claim to fame among all my French friends, that I came home from Volnay with a 5 euro wine that also my French friend said, now that is a good deal. So we bought a lot of that before we ended up leaving there. then I did make a couple of more trips to Burgundy, to a couple of other places, just gathered up everything I could. I maxed out all my credit cards, of course, you know, just spent every dime I could possibly spend, and ended up coming home with 300 bottles of French wine. And, of course, we also had a lot of Alsatians. I should say something about them because, you know, we lived in the Alsace. We knew the Route du Vin. We took people on this trip many, many times and knew some of the winemakers personally and so on. And the Alsatian white wines, the Tokay Pinot Gris, the Pinot Blanc, the Gewürztraminer, the Riesling, and so on. These are great wines and lots of fun. I mean, I don't get the biggest bang personally out of whites as over against reds, but still it was very, very nice.
Mickey, how do you feel about screw caps?
I'm all for it. Well, I mean, if it works. I don't know. I mean, this kind of goes back to the stuff you asked me about Davis. That is winemaking a science or is it an art? And I think the answer is simple. Of course, it's both. But, you know, maybe the real problem is whether one predominates or the other. And I think in the end, you know, you can't just hand winemaking over to the scientists, because I'm sure at some point we'll be able to, you know, like analyze the palate in such a way that we can construct, you know, a taste experience that's like a great wine. I think that'll be a sad day, you know, if it happens. But it does have to do with that whole thing of, you know, sort of the science end of it as opposed to the more sort of artsy romantic side. And I can tell you this. I bought some 92 Burgundy Premier Cru, brought it home. I had a case of it, and I had 4 bad corks. And all I could think of was, wow, I wish he had those synthetic corks. I wish he had something else because this wine's ruined and, you know, my money's wasted and I had to, you know, pop it out at a party or something. And so I was really disappointed. So I've had enough experiences with bad corks to think that you got to do something.
Tell me more about living in France.
My last trip to Burgundy before we left, I drove by myself and went to my sort of favorite places. Got 6 of this, 6 of that. And then I went to a little village called Alloc-Corton. And Alloc-Corton, they have a cooperative tasting room where a bunch of the local wineries sort of cooperate in this thing. And this was like a Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, you know, or something like that. And I'm like popping into this place. I taste a couple of wines. There's one guy in there behind the counter, young guy, probably, you know, 30, 35. There's nobody else in the whole place the whole time. So I taste a couple of wines. I buy some stuff. And then I'm just sitting there with the guy and I say, do you mind if I ask you a kind of a personal question? And he was a very friendly fellow, and he agreed. And so I said, what's it like living here? I said, do you just, like, drink really great wine all the time? And he looked, and he said, well, yes. Yes, I think we do. And then he told me about his grandfather's, like, 80th birthday party. And they'd gone to the cellar. And pulled out, I think he said, I don't know, the 27s and the 47s. They had pulled out just these amazing wines. And as I sat there listening to him telling this story, I was thinking, how do I get reincarnated? As you know, how do you get so lucky as to be born in a Alloc-Corton to a winemaker?
Yeah. Mickey, thanks for taking the time to come by the studio and talk to us.
Thank you, Ray. It's great fun. I hope you can do something with this.